think advertising on TikTok isn't for your business? Think again.
We've generated over 100,000 leads, which has converted into over 40,000 sales for our pet insurance policies. My name is Trey Farrow. I am the CEO of Spot Pet Insurance. TikTok's Smart Plus AI-powered automation takes the guesswork out of targeting, bidding, and optimizing creative. If I can advertise on TikTok, you can too.
Drive more leads and scale your business today, only on TikTok. Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
It's The Wonky Show. It's a May 17th return to campus, but is that too late? Plus, there's news on students and sex work, controversy over inclusive assessment, and a new campaign on London Waiting. It's all coming up.
I feel very strongly about getting the right people to the right places to fix the right problems. And look, if the cure for cancer is inside the mind of a 19-year-old who struggles with a semicolon, then that's fine by me. And I think the funniest thing about it is that
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us understand what's going on this week, as usual, two fantastic guests. In Haddenham, Nick Hillman is director at the Higher Education Policy Institute, or HEPI. Nick, your highlight of the week?
Well, I think I've got a professional one and a personal one. Professionally, I've been getting to know a new colleague that HEPI's recently taken on board, Lucy Hare, who many people in the sector will know, and it's going to be a crucial part of HEPI's work going forward. And I've enjoyed being able to sit in the garden in the slightly better weather, watching. We have two little kittens who are exploring the outside for the first time, watching them frolic around. So it's felt properly springtime.
Oh, excellent. And in Exeter, Sunday Blake is president at the Students Guild at the University of Exeter. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
I also have a personal and professional one. So my personal one is I took a lateral flow test for the first time yesterday. And professionally, so the 12th of April saw a lot of hospitality outlets opening, and I got to see lots of my students meeting up with other students and filling the air with joy and happiness. And it did make my heart sort of swell to see them having a good time after such a difficult year.
Excellent. So we start this week with return to campus. After a couple of weeks of unusually public lobbying, the government revealed this week that students who've not yet returned to campus for in-person teaching in England won't be allowed to do so until May the 17th at the earliest. Nick, pull this apart for us.
Well, and it's important, I think, as you said then, that we recognise this is really an England only story. But the announcement was that more face-to-face teaching, beyond the face-to-face teaching that's already happening for some courses, cannot happen now until the 17th of May at the earliest, which for many courses and many institutions is too late, many students, of course, too late to be meaningful. And it's slightly odd because the big government document outlining this announcement starts with all the reasons as to why actually universities are not particularly dangerous environments for the transmission of COVID. The first three points are universities have worked very hard to make their environments safe, that there's only very limited evidence that in-person teaching spreads this virus, and also that the risks for staff are no higher than in other occupations. So it's very odd that universities are not being allowed to reopen their campuses.
And actually, Nick, just before you carry on, there's an amusing difference. So that DfE document, when it was originally published in March, it gave that evidence. And now, now DfE has added the word anecdotal at the front of that sentence on evidence, presumably to downplay the meaning of the evidence now that a different decision has been made.
Indeed. And there's some wonderful sort of textual critique of the two documents, the old version and the new version, on the Wonky website that I would draw people's attention to, because it's very useful, and that is one of the very odd, subtle but odd changes. I find, of course, we're all very, many of us, I'm with you, UK, and the Russell Group and University of Lancet and everybody else, in being frustrated by this announcement. The government and the UCU obviously approve of it, but it's really the absence of an announcement, because actually what they've done is just delay a firm decision till a bit later. So we're all talking about it as if the government's announced something. They've really not really announced anything at all. They've announced the status quo continuing for longer than many of us feel is reasonable, given what's happening in the rest of society, given that most students are already back at their term time address, at least that's what our polling suggests, and when the government has said that they want to be evidence-led and driven by the data, not by other things. And it just feels to many of us that that isn't quite what's been happening here. So I think it is a regrettable, poorly explained decision. I've gone so far to say in one speech I made earlier this week that I actually think it was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, misstep the government has made, specifically in relation to higher education since the crisis began. And I think there's a lot of frustration out there. Sunday we'll have views, of course, but among students that they can do lots of things, but they can't have face-to-face teaching on many courses.
Sunday, isn't this fair enough? You know, we are still in the middle of a global pandemic, and, you know, it wasn't going to make that much difference by this time at the end of the year anyway. And, you know, students haven't been vaccinated, and, you know, they'll be spreading the virus. This is a perfectly reasonable decision, isn't it?
This is frustrating for me because, like Nick said, I do feel that the guidance that was given a few months ago has turned, and I don't think that putting anecdotal in front of it negates it at all. I was sat in September all the way through till Christmas with a lot of students saying that they were concerned about in-person teaching during the lockdowns, and I've now got this situation where the government was saying, no, it's fine, everything's fine, the university was saying it's fine. And now it's almost like the opposite is happening. The government is saying, actually, it's not safe enough. And I think, well, it's really interesting because all of last term, you were sort of telling us it was, and now suddenly it's not. Well, actually, the vaccine rollouts have been incredibly successful thanks to the NHS. A lot of students who are vulnerable have been vaccinated. I know all of our disabled students in our disabled groups have been vaccinated, and I'm really struggling to see where the concern is. And I'm quite a risk adverse person. I sort of worked from home the whole way through the pandemic. Even when we were allowed to come onto campus, I didn't come in. And at the point, I'm at this point where I'm thinking, this doesn't to me feel like it's a harm reductive measure. At this point, it feels to me that we are trying to allow students to go back right at the end of the year, so that when students inevitably, and they are, raising issues, writing complaints, asking for refunds, saying their education contract hasn't been fulfilled, it's so that, you know, universities can turn around and say, oh, well, actually, you know, you have had some face-to-face teaching. This is also why universities are scrabbling around to put on sort of extra curricular activities over the summer to somehow supplement students' learning and pacify any complaints they may be getting.
Nick, the quote that really caught the imagination of lots of people this week was Greg Galbraith at Portsmouth saying, the VC at Portsmouth saying, throughout the pandemic, the overwhelming majority of students have behaved very well and can now go to the pub, get a tattoo or drive cross country for a self-catered holiday. The only thing they can't do is access in-person teaching. And the tattoo thing, you know, it's caught on. Lots of people have kind of requoted that. But it's not, you know, surely that's not really the point, is it? Because at any one time you can take two different aspects of society or two different groups in society and say, look, they're not, you know, the comparison is fair on one group and not fair on the other. Isn't the point that at any one time you have to have some people, some settings, some parts of the country that are restricted because you're very slowly reopening? You have to have a slow reopening in order to manage the impact of the pandemic, don't you?
So it is a great blog by Graham Galbraith. Anyone who thinks vice chancellors never put their head above the parapet and really speak out should read what he's got to say. It's full of juicy quotes like that, which albeit have slightly annoyed some tattooists and people who are very keen on tattoos if you look on social media. But I don't actually accept the premise behind your question for two reasons. The first is, like you, I'm a parent and my kids have been back at school, thank the Lord, for a number of weeks now. And there's been a sense, I think, throughout the crisis that higher education and schools' decisions should be in some way linked. There seems to be no link at all within the DfE between their decision making on pre-18 education and their decision making on post-18 education, at least when it comes to universities. And the second thing I would say is that earlier in the crisis, we were told that education would be a priority over all those other things. So if it's the case that we can't move in sync across the board in every area of life equally, why is it the universities are being put at the back of the queue rather than at the front of the queue?
Yeah, okay, all right, fair enough. but look, hold on, Nick. Isn't it mainly because throughout the rest of education, apart from some bits and bobs in sort of boarding schools, you're not talking about major population moves, right? I mean, you know, people are in their local area. Isn't this about migration? You know, into UK migration and actually international migration into the country temporarily.
Yeah, but in theory, it might be. But you should change your understanding of theory when the data tells you something different. And the data tells us that somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of students are already at their term time address. So the weakest of all the government's arguments is students can't have more face-to-face teaching till the 17th of May because they'll have to travel back to their university address. I mean, I'd be great to hear from a Sunday if that's the story in Exeter.
I mean, half the problem is the government hasn't actually published any data to support this particular decision.
I would also add that the data that we have not only justifies in-person teaching because it says that 2/3 of students are back, but I'd also say that it's probably more than that, and students haven't declared that they're back. And I know that for a fact because when we found a World War II bomb on campus and it had to evacuate halls of residence, we found around 300 extra students there. So we know that students are back. And 2/3 is an underestimate, in my opinion, because students are just not declaring that they're back. Of course they've come back.
Okay, all right. Well, look, Nick, you are quite kind of close to, you know, analysing government policy. You kind of live and breathe this every day. If this decision makes zero sense and it's upset lots of people, why on earth has it been made?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I really do, but... of course, it does show, I think, somewhat of a disregard for our sector in the corridors of power. Our sector's often struggled to have the voice that it, in my view, deserves in the corridors of power across Whitehall. And of course, these sorts of decisions, they're not just taken in the DfE. They're taken in Number 10 and they're taken in, the Treasury and the Cabinet Office and the sort of really powerful government departments. And we've just somehow slipped down the priority list. And that's regrettable. I think it's a great shame that the ministers that represent our sector, the Minister for Universities and the Minister for Research, are less senior jobs in government than they used to be. Whatever people think of Dominic Cummings, he actually gave our voice, certainly some elements of what universities do, a powerful voice in the middle of Number 10 Downing Street, and he's gone. So I just think we've somehow slipped down the pecking order, and that's really worrying with the spending review coming up later in the year and, you know, post-COVID decisions to be made. So we need to learn from this. This tells us actually something about how policy is made that we need to recall and digest and respond to.
Sunday, at the significant risk of kind of breaking one of my own rules, which is to ask the student person on the panel, what do students think? What's your sense of how students regard this decision in the kind of wider context of politics? Because, you know, I read some stuff that says, well, you know, students are always going to be left wing and will hate a Tory government. But is something else going on here? Is this sense that students have been forgotten worse over the way the pandemic's played out?
Oh, absolutely. No, students feel that across the board. I have a wide range of friends with different political opinions.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
A very good friend of mine is just stepping down as the Conservative Association chair, and he thinks the same. I think at the point now it's not anger anymore. You know, we saw a lot of anger, a lot of open letters and petitions happening. I actually think that students are in a state of exhaustion at the minute. I think that it is indefensible how students have been treated, and I think that this actually transcends political allegiances at this point.
And Nick, this takes us back to that. So, you know, one of the things that you've done at fairly regular intervals, actually, is track the kind of political opinions of students and to, you know, think about and speculate how that might impact elections and so on. And we're back here again, aren't we, to this thing about, is it, you know, is it the sector that tells students to be left-wing, or is it students that tell the sector and students to be left-wing, and how long will students harbour these opinions if they feel, you know, forgotten or betrayed? You know, is there a moment in their 30s where they switch to being more right wing? All of that stuff is kind of in the mix here.
Yeah, it's a huge and really interesting issue. And sometimes people talk about the student vote as if it's a sort of unchanging thing. But given the turnover of students, you know, most people do a degree for about 3 years or so and then go off into the labour market. We're talking every election is a completely different group of voters, pretty much. And they're not fixed. They don't always vote, you know, Labour, for example. Actually, there have been elections where, you know, the Lib Dems have done very well. Or there was one European election where I think the Greens and the Tories jointly topped the student vote. So it's wrong to think of them as a completely fixed, unchanging morass. And of course, the next general election probably won't be till 2024. So actually, the next election, when it comes round, will have, again, an almost completely different group of students to the ones we've currently got. In fact, we'll have people whose schooling and GCSEs and A-levels have been incredibly disrupted by the current crisis, and they may vote accordingly, depending on, you know, how policymakers respond to the crisis once the worst of the crisis is over.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, Claire Adams here, Head of University Success at Handshake UK. I have a piece on OneKey this week entitled Digital Capital is a Whole System Issue. Building it takes more than hardware. The piece explores the importance of acknowledging both the digital divide and digital capital as higher education plans for a more blended student experience, as well as highlighting that digital and offline environments do not exist separate from one another. Existing patterns of inclusion or exclusion that impact students' learning connections, outcomes and experiences overall still exist in a digital environment. Handshake's latest research finds that while technology and virtual recruitment practices ought to be a huge leveller in creating opportunities for students, many employers are swapping one closed network for another, with 63% of employers we spoke to saying they were now more reliant on online professional networks, and a further 57% saying they are more reliant on personal or word-of-mouth referrals, a practice we are calling nepotism. We've only really begun to scratch the surface of these issues. However, as we collectively begin to further our understanding, and as universities and employers across the globe look to transform their work in a post-COVID world, there is huge potential to work collaboratively with technology providers to truly build back better.
Now, next up, it says here that university students will not be marked down for poor spelling, bad grammar and incorrect punctuation. Surely not. Sunday, what's all this about?
Yeah, so Monday there was an article in the Times looking at the efforts of some universities to adopt more inclusive assessments. And this has sparked a series of opinion pieces on whether it is elitist to require correct grammar and spelling, there we go. Is that elitist? I don't know. It is early in the morning. Early mornings are elitist. The London University of Arts has guided staff to actively accept spelling, grammar or other language mistakes that do not significantly impede communication unless the brief states, you get the point. There was readers' letters in the Times who are very critical of the idea. Opinion piece from Melanie Phillip, she called it a cultural wrecking ball. Obviously some Telegraph pieces, John Humphreys weighed in, And actually ended up with the Office of Students publishing a response, distancing itself from the practice with a published response. I mean, to be honest, I'm not a pedagogical expert, but I do actually find this quite boring. I was a little bit confused because, you know, contextual offers exist and mitigation and reasonable adjustments have always existed. But I thought I would try and grapple to it, which is why I messaged you, Jim, about midnight last night saying, where did this come from? I can't actually find the original guidance, because all I could find was verbatim woke brigade, postmodernism, social justice warriors, Orwell's 1994. I mean, the hyperbole, or should I say the hyperbole, is astounding. And I'm actually too tired to engage with it. I don't think it's decrying the end of the English language. I especially don't think that, as one writer said, that doctors will no longer be examined on whether to decipher the heart from the lungs. I mean, it's just old man shouts at cloud, really. As I said, I'm not a pedagogical expert, but I am in HE because I feel very strongly about getting the right people to the right places to fix the right problems. And look, if the cure for cancer is inside the mind of a 19-year-old who struggles with a semicolon, then that's fine by me. And I think the funniest thing about it is that every single article, every single one of them, mocked the concept by writing a sentence with bad spelling. So they put students have the right, spelled R-I-T-E, or exams, spelled E-S-C-A-M, you know, to hone in on their point about clarity and precision. But I was laughing because it backfired, because I knew exactly what they meant. And it just completely undermined their point. They were like, here, I'm going to spell a word wrong to make my point about clarity. But everyone understood it. So I think this is all a bit of hype over nothing, to be honest. It's not official policy from Office for Students with in terms of guidance. You know, students still need to get entry-level requirements to get into university. They have to exhibit a level of proficiency. I just think that it's become a little bit, you know, a bit over the top to me. But what do I know? I don't write for The Times or The Telegraph.
Or The Mail. Now, Nick, this speaks to some, you know, wider issues, doesn't it, about what higher education means and who ought to go.
It does. And also it speaks about the size of the sector, I think. You know, many of the authors writing those articles the Sundays just mentioned went to university many decades ago, long before we had a mass university system. And I've always thought the shift from an elite to a university to a mass university system does have to necessitate changes at the institutional end. And, you know, and this is partly what's going on here, that it's universities responding to their student bodies. And I think, it was interesting that one of the examples was an arts university, where, of course, you know, your precision on your grammar and your spelling, if you're doing a jewellery design course or something, it's probably less important than if you're doing an English language or an English literature course. But I've got to say, I mean, I am in two minds on this one, because and one of the frustrating things about this week is people shouting over each other rather than actually discussing the real content. I think both sides sound a bit shrill and a bit defensive. I'm in two minds about it, because of course we do students a disservice if we imply that some of these things don't matter at all, because when they come to put in job applications, for example, these things, you know, your job application could literally go into the bin if you have more than one or two spelling mistakes or grammatical mistakes. And both your organisation, Jim Wonky and Happy, take, we both spend huge amounts of time editing other people's work to make sure it's grammatically accurate. And so I don't want to come across as too hypocritical by saying none of this matters. I think it does matter. But I also think one of the things that surprised me in the commentary is none of the pieces that I've read taking the mickey out of these universities for doing this end by saying, well, maybe, just maybe, if there's problems in the quality of students' written work, maybe, just maybe, it's something to do with resources and support for students. None of them said, none of them noted, for example, the increase in the staff-student ratio since they were a university. And if it's the case that they think universities are following the wrong path here, well, you know, universities would need a hell of a lot of extra resources to do the things some of these commentators are saying they should be doing.
Yeah, and Sunday, none of them said, I mean, you know, just to carry on Nick's point a bit here, none of them talked about what happens before people get to university either. I mean, it's this, oh, universities have done, what have universities done? Universities haven't done anything at this point other than...
I think there's two sort of points that have come up in what Nick said that I would like to respond to. I think Nick's absolutely right. And, you know, someone who churns out a lot of written content myself, you know, he's 100% right that for some roles and professions and remits do require that incredibly detailed attention to grammar and spelling. But for some students, that's just not the case. And it always reminds me of that teacher in maths, right, who said to me, you need to learn long division because you're not always going to have a calculator in your pocket. And I'm like, well, welcome to 2021. Here's my iPhone and it's always in my pocket. And I just think that, you know, we do have technology and systems in place that work towards eradicating the more arduous and laborious parts of academic labour. That is something that happens. I don't know what's going to be here in 2031, but, you know, in 2011, I was being told I wouldn't always have a calculator in my pocket, and now I do. So, you know, we can talk about things like Grammarly, different AIs that are helping students with their grammar and spelling. That makes that attention less important. And the other thing I think is that what I really... I want to point out, and I say this a lot, is that I understand that, you know, when people say, grammar and spelling is elitism. Now, I take offence by that. And I actually did agree with some of the writers because I'm very vocal about the fact I come from a working class background. I'm care experienced, and 6% of care experienced students go to university. If someone turned around to me when I got in and said, you probably can't spell, I would think, excuse me, yes, I can. But this grouping of underperformers in and mediocre students into widening participation groups, and the idea that widening participation schemes are responsible for mediocre students sitting on seats. Well, okay, let me throw that back at you, because I've met some mediocre students at university, and they didn't come from wine and participation circles. They came from schools that taught them how to shroud their mediocrity in good grammar. Now, there is something that is never discussed. Are we going to start saying, stop looking at the grammar and start looking at the content of essays? I think that, you know, class background does have an impact on how you express yourself. So I have to say that whilst I agree with them that, yes, widening participation groups of students do have the intellect and the ability to produce high academic quality content, let's not forget that actually a lot of people, and I look at some of the writers in I'm not pointing out to these particular writers around this piece, but, you know, there are people who write for papers, who come to Exeter and give talks. And I think, yes, what you're saying is incredibly grammatically correct, it's incredibly eloquent, but you're not really saying anything. So I do think that there is something to be said here about focusing on content.
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it, Nick? I mean, you know, you will know this. When you get a blog in, sometimes it's really well written but doesn't really say anything, and then other times it's really badly written and you have to spend a bit of time on it. But my God, is the point powerful?
Yeah, I think that's true. And of course, writing in a easily accessible way is a great skill. But as Sunday said, it's more relevant to some professions and some careers than others. I mean, what I take away from this is I just wish the editors of our great national newspapers had a slightly more diverse group of people on their speed dial when it comes to commissioning articles about our sector. You know, Melanie Phillips, John Humphreys, you know, they're both very interesting people, but we've probably heard, you know, we know what they think about higher education. You know, if we're going to learn from this row and this debate, let's hear some new voices and some a wider range of commentators.
Yes, for example, you know, it's a good point, Nick. I never would have thought when I turned on The Right Stuff the other day that I would hear from Eve Pollard on this subject, but here's a little clip.
Totally, completely. How are you ever going to get a job when you can't spell? I mean, it's crazy that it thinks it's white and it's male and it's something. I used to, I mean, I'm so old that when I started out meeting blokes, They used to write me letters, and when they couldn't spell, I dropped them. I mean, I just thought there's no point carrying on with this bloke. He's obviously never read anything and probably can barely write because he couldn't spell. It's essential. And in fact, let's face it, in the old days, we'd be taught how to spell when we were 6, 7, and 8, when it's easy to absorb that stuff, and they should bring that back.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
Durham University is set up in order to extract the vast wealth of the Bishop of Durham, put it to useful purpose. And so they get off and set off in a very clear mode that they're like Oxford and Cambridge colleges, traditional curriculum, although they do branch out and do new and exciting things like an engineering course. But what happens later is there's a civic need for higher education. So Owens, John Owens, is a merchant, and he sees, well, what Manchester needs is its own college. So he founds, by giving them a sizable amount of money in his bequest, a college to be set up. And obviously they set up and they say, great, we'll have a university. But the other towns in the north say, oh, no, you can't have a university on your own. We have to have something along the same kind of lines. And so there's a sense that, well, you can't possibly set up just one college to do that. So Owens is refused, after it's been going for a few years, the right to become a university. So what it gets is a federal university, an examining university, kind of similar to the University of London. So the university will set the exams and Owens College will do the teaching. Now, the weird thing is, for the first couple of years, it's only Owens College is the only college of this, and the Victoria University only has the one college. But Liverpool and Leeds both get their act together and set up colleges and apply to join. And so over time, they get a federal university, which is a bit of an awkward compromise. The federal university is chaired in turn by the vice-chancellors of the different universities. They all teach the same curriculum. The students all take the same examination. They're all graduates of the Victoria University. And that's ticking along okay, until Birmingham wants to develop its college. It's got a college, it's got a generous donor, Josiah Mason, who's given them plenty of cash. He's a businessman. And they're setting off in the same way. They're going to have a federal university too. There's going to be University of the Midlands. There's talk in Bristol of a University of the Southwest. This is the pattern we're all going to go to. But they, instead of proceeding on their happy path, Joseph Chamberlain becomes president of Josiah Mason College. Incidentally, he was a business competitor of Josiah Mason, but he becomes president of this college, and part of his big thing for Birmingham is to take this college forward. But he's also made rector of Glasgow University, so he spends quite a lot of time in Glasgow, and he likes two things about it. Firstly, he likes the fact that they've taken the campus out of the city centre and put it in an attractive new campus, so he likes that idea. He also likes that it's the University of Glasgow, not some kind of mixed, you know, federal university somewhere else. It's a university for the city, doing things for the city, and which people are very proud of. So when he comes back to Birmingham, he says, we're not having a federal university. We're going to have a University of Birmingham. We're not, you know, otherwise I'm going to give up and we're going to, you know, stuff the lot of you. So because he happens, just so happens to be a member of the cabinet, he bends the will of Whitehall to say, we're going to have a single teaching university. University of Birmingham will not have any extra colleges. It'll just be a university on its own. And that will be, you know, that's going to be the whole of it. He gets, by dint of that, to erase the name of Josiah Mason from the name of the college. Obviously not part of his original plan. So the University of Birmingham goes off on its way, and Mason is gently let to be forgotten. Now, this excites the people in Liverpool because they've got their university college, but they're part of the Victoria University. And they say, well, hang on a second, if Birmingham can have its own university, we've got to have our own university. So they petition to have the Victoria University wound up and then become a university in their own right. So you'd expect the Victoria University to object to this a bit, but the University of the Yorkshire College really objects. Probably, the speculation is because they're a bit weedy, a bit small, and unlikely to become a university in their own right. So they make a strong objection to the winding up of the Victoria University. So Liverpool's kind of trapped. Manchester Owens College is thinking, well, we could be our own university, that'd be quite good. But Leeds is vehemently against. So the Privy Council, who's the only people in charge of universities or education at that time, forms a committee, a really high-powered committee. And the kind of people who go and pitch to this committee are Haldane, who, you know, famous for all of these other exciting higher education things, Sidney Webb, all sorts of really Portland reformers think the idea of a teaching university is worth pressing, so they hold this great committee hearing. And the minutes are fabulous, because there's just mad arguments. The people on both sides argue with each other. These senior politicians play out all their arguments. There's some great dialogue as people say, you know, are you bringing standards down by setting up your own university? Oh, no, we're not, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of this, the Privy Council agree that Liverpool can be its own university. Manchester can keep the Victoria University, which incidentally is why it was called the Victoria University of Manchester through to its merger with UMIST. But then that leaves Leeds in a slightly complicated position, because Yorkshire College has been arguing that it really believes in federal universities as a way of kind of keeping the thing going. So the Privy Council turn around and say, OK, you can be a federal university. Well done. There's a college in Sheffield that'd like to join you. Now, suddenly the people in Leeds get really cold feet, because they quite now fancy the idea of being their own university and don't really want to have the Firth College people in Sheffield join them in a new federal university. So they get cold feet about this. So they write a charter saying, hello, we'd like to be the Victoria University of Yorkshire. And they send it in. But the Privy Council think, well, hang on a second, if you don't want to play this federal game, you can't be the University of Yorkshire, because you don't want to include everybody in Yorkshire in it. So there's a wonderful copy in the records in the National Archives, where what they do is they amend the charter by crossing out every mention of Yorkshire and writing Leeds in pen in the copy of the charter and send it back to them saying, you can have this charter, but you're going to be the University of Leeds. You can't be the University of Yorkshire. So it's the beginning of the end of the federal principle. When it comes to it, the universities in the colleges that form the Southwest, they're not keen. The final attempt is to set one up in the East Midlands. And so when they lay the foundation stone at the University of Nottingham, there's still a sense in the 20s that they might found an East Midlands university. But Loughborough and Leicester aren't keen. They want to have their own universities eventually. And the federal principle in England dies off.
Now, next up, there's been a surge in the number of students selling sex since lockdowns began. The English Collective of Prostitutes said calls to its helpline from young people at university and college have risen by a third this year. Sunday, tell us more.
Towards the end of last year, the University of Leicester published a toolkit to help staff support students engaged in sex work. The university claimed its aim was to positively support its students whilst fulfilling its legal obligation to safeguard vulnerable adults and children. The toolkit takes a non-judgmental approach to sex work, while increasing numbers of students have turned to sex work for money during the pandemic. This was covered extensively. I could have predicted this, actually, because I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, Brighton University had a stall at their Freshers' Fair, where they were given advice on how to stay safe in sex work, and they had a similar coverage. I think what both incidences of press attention left out, which as a student representative breaks my heart, is that both of these were instigated and executed by student sex workers themselves, specifically student sex workers who'd had quite a bad time in the industry. Obviously, this has also highlighted the economic reasons behind students selling explicit images on sites like OnlyFans, but some other platforms, sort of like the Mail and Telegraph, have been a lot more critical towards the university, and claiming in some cases that the universities were acting as pimps by proxy, which I take, that's just bad. A bad interpretation of it, genuinely, mainly because students aren't engaging in sex work to pay tuition. They are paying rent, bills, food, that sort of thing. There's not much scratching under the surface that's going on. And I think it's very easy to get very outraged about this. Prostitution is such an old divide. But I think what this was trying to do and has done is open up conversations around sex work and let student sex workers know that the university will support them. And that's actually very important, because a lot of universities have morality clauses. So that is that if you go into the disciplinary documents, you can find morality clauses where if the student is engaged in behavior that brings the university into disrepute, they can be removed from the university, they can be fined, and this is really important because it has really, really knock-on effects. if a student sex worker isn't comfortable coming to the university, they're not going to be able to approach wellbeing. They're not going to be able to apply for hardship funds. You know, hardship funds infamously ask for 3 months of bank statements, and student sex workers don't necessarily want their transactions for hotels or private sexual health clinics being shown to the universities. They can be evicted from their homes. So rent from immoral earnings is still a reason that people can be evicted. And most worryingly is that all sex workers can actually have their children removed from their care. Now, we know from work with the English Collective of Prostitutes that 2 out of 3 student sex workers are actually parents as well. So this is, you know, it goes against this idea that student sex workers are, well, quite ageist and sexist stereotypes, that sex workers are all young, naive women being pushed into sex work by their institution, who's painting it as a glamorous career. Actually, the data shows that the majority of student sex workers are parents who are juggling, you know, childcare, the degree, and the need for income in a short space of time. Again, we are approaching sex work with our preconceived ideas of who a sex worker is.
Nick, you know, has something changed now? Is something new going on here? You know, has the pandemic exacerbated something, or is this just, you know, the tabloids being, you know, producing the same old stories?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, at least twice a year, the story comes round about the proportion of students doing sex work for money. And I actually welcome Leicester's initiative, by the way, because I think anybody who actually reads what Leicester have produced will realise it's actually a very responsible document with links to all sorts of helplines and things like that. I don't believe there's been a big increase in the number of students undertaking sex work, because I say that advisedly and carefully. But I say it because a lot of the data in this area is really bad. I mean, really bad. So a lot of it comes, for example, from things like Save Our Student surveys, actually about students' finances, not primarily about sex work, and they are not normally representative polls either. So we've actually, at HEPI, undertaken our own survey on all these issues, which we'll be publishing later this month on the 29th of April, where we suggest that we find that actually only 1% of the students in our survey, to give you one tiny little data point from it, only 1% of the students in our survey have actually experience of sex work. Sunday has rightly pointed out to me that our survey is primarily of young students, and some students undertaking sex work are older. But 1% is very different from, for example, the 7% number that has been floating around from other polls. I think at heart, of course, this is about finance for many students. And one of the very many bits of the Auger report we're still waiting for a proper response to is whether there should be a proper detailed review by the Office for Students or somebody else about students' living costs. And we set maintenance numbers almost randomly. And I would actually like to see that bit of the Auger report probably taken forward. So it's not just a conversation that the tabloids love to write about in rather salacious detail about students, sex workers, but it's a wider conversation about students' employment and students' living costs.
Sunday, set aside this question of prevalence for a minute. That, you know, more broadly, I have found myself talking to all sorts of people this week about harm reduction, because one of my predictions is that out the back of the pandemic, we will end up with students undertaking much riskier behaviours more generally, you know, in relation to all sorts of aspects, which are a cut and shut of people being cooped up for a long period of time, and also people, you know, suddenly having some freedom, and also people not having a lot of money. But, you know, have we got a debate coming again about harm reduction and kind of condemnation in the press of young people and their behaviours, and then young people saying, well, what we need is support and pragmatism? You know, is that coming?
Well, it's already here, Jim. I think, you know, anything around risky behaviour, drug consumption, drinking, student sex work, any behaviour that's risky results primarily in the condemnation of the students partaking in it, and then in condemning the support systems that jump up around them in trying to reduce that harm. I think, you know, as as you've rightly pointed out, this is about the cost of living. This is about rent, bills and food. It's about the fact that, you know, sex work requires no qualifications, no barrier, no formal interview. They can work from home. Visas with limited working hours for international students can be circumvented with an informal labour market that sex work is. Students at Oxford and Cambridge can do part-time work during term time because of its secretive nature. You know, there's all these systems in place that students are having to navigate, and sex work is what they turn to because it's the thing that gets them through. I think what frustrates me is that I don't see the outrage circus rallying around these issues, of which student sex work is a symptom, not the cause. Where was the mass outrage and headlines around students forced to pay rent on rooms that they weren't in with income they didn't have through the pandemic? There was no outrage for that from these particular writers, and yet when students were turning to make very difficult decisions around their income, around where they find the money for those empty rooms, that's when the outrage has come in.
The pandemic drives the latest in a long line of changes to the way students access learning resources. In the main, students no longer buy their own books, which puts pressure on libraries to support access to materials. The slow shift to e-resources has been amplified by this year's emergency remote learning. Libraries argue that publishers are setting prices too high, and in using bundle deals make resources harder to buy. Academics are concerned that they cannot use the best materials to support learning. Students complain that they can't access the resources they need, and publishers worry that their business models are not fit for purpose. We don't know exactly what the future should look like, but we know things are changing more rapidly than anyone had anticipated. On the 28th of April, we are running a Wonky at Home event in partnership with Cortext in the form of a micro-commission on learning resources. Our expert commissioners, supported by you, the attendees, will hear the evidence from students, academics, librarians, publishers and researchers. We'll examine how students really engage with learning resources and tackle the thorniest of questions. Who should pay for these resources? You should go to wonky.com/events to book your place for this event.
And finally, London Higher has published a report on the impact of removing the London Waiting in HE funding allocations, supposedly in pursuit of the government's levelling up agenda. Nick, what's your old colleague Diana Beach up to here?
Well, I think, Diana is really grabbing the bull by the horns at London Higher, and she's really gripped onto this issue that was in the grant letter in January from the department, the Office for Students, essentially saying the extra teaching grant that the government via the OFS gives to London universities should disappear. It exists, of course, because there are genuinely extra costs in delivering higher education. In fact, any education in London, because of things like extra staffing costs, salaries are higher in London. The government, of course, though, is aware that London universities are a great success story. They have expanded a lot, including among more disadvantaged students. They have adopted a conception of levelling up that seems to necessitate levelling down for the areas of the country that have had these extra money. And I don't think that's really what people thought the government meant by levelling up when they first started talking about levelling up. But it does seem to be what it means, because the teaching grant is pretty much frozen. So you have to reduce somebody's income from the teaching grant if you're going to increase somebody else's. So what the government's doing is, very straightforwardly reducing money to London institutions and increasing it a bit for others. And so they're seeing it as a zero-sum game. It's about £64 million in question. Some Diana's numbers show, for example, that one university will go from a £2 million deficit to a £5 million deficit. I think my number one takeaway from that bit of work is the reminder that not all London universities are the same. So if there's people in Whitehall that think, well, maybe they're really big names in London, full of international students, they'll be okay. That's not true of every single higher education institution in London. And it's really timely, this campaign, because there's an OFS consultation on the change. There's a London mayoral election going on. There's a spending review being prepared in Whitehall. My final point, though, is London Higher, are fighting a good campaign, and they need to fight a good campaign, because when I dipped my toe in this water a few years ago and I suggested the maintenance support package for students in London should be even higher, the disparity between the London maintenance package, the package for elsewhere, should be bigger, because London is such an expensive place to live. The comments I got, it was in a Guardian piece below that piece, from people who saying London gets everything, why should London have yet more, were very vehement, very strongly felt. So London High have done the right thing here. They're bringing real evidence to the table to show why this is not just special pleading. This is actually a real issue about the diversity of London institutions and their students, who are poorer very often on average than other students, need to be taken seriously.
Sunday, so far this is about institutional funding, right? But I guess it wouldn't be unreasonable to assume that one of the things that might happen when AUGA comes along, the final response to AUGA review comes along, is that someone starts looking at the London waiting on the maintenance loan. And one of the questions that does come up a lot is, if you look at those league tables that come out from from accommodation providers and so on, every 5 minutes you've got a kind of cost of living index around the country. There's no doubt that some university towns and cities are really, really expensive to live in. Why should London get all the waiting when, quite a few of those, for example, that tumble into the inbox would tell me that Exeter's an extraordinarily expensive place to live?
So I think, this is something that I struggle with, and I do feel quite strongly about it, because I hear a lot of arguments that disadvantaged students in London are more likely to stay in London for their university. So, if you're looking at the London universities, you can pinpoint that there are disadvantaged students from London boroughs going to London universities. And a lot of the higher institution providers that they're going to are the ones that will be training key workers, will be contributing to widened participation. So I think that's quite important to talk about. But I do think that there is, in these conversations, there is an overlook around things like, or places like the Southwest, for example. So I'm in Exeter. I am acutely aware that our intake from the local region is so small. Okay, we don't actually get that many students from the Southwest coming to Exeter University. And on top of that, our transport routes are absolutely awful, right? So I think that there was a student that I met who lived in Cornwall, and she was travelling in on a bus that left her village three times a day. It took 2 hours. So of course I appreciate that, conversations around London waiting need to focus on the cost of living in London, but we also need to acknowledge that London has very good transport routes, is very well connected. And in these conversations, what I don't want to get lost is the disadvantaged students who live in impoverished areas of places like Cornwall.
Nick, I'm accused a lot of cynicism and pessimism, but I think it's reasonable at this point for me to worry about the extent to which a good, proper, sophisticated look at maintenance will be delivered as part of that AUGA review response.
Well, yes. I mean, they've had time to come up with a considered response, certainly, but whether that time has been used appropriately. It's interesting because, of course, when I worked in Whitehall, and we did slightly increase, actually, the total maintenance package when the fees went up in 2012 in England, I did see that often these decisions are just a bit random. The maintenance package went up a bit in 2012 because it was a bit of a sop, in return for the fees going up. And also there was some politics as well, of course, between the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. But it wasn't, I've got to admit, it wasn't a considered assessment of the current cost of living for students. And one of those is probably overdue. The AUGA report recommended it. It should happen, I think. And some of the student accommodation providers are up for that conversation. We should never be afraid of the evidence. And what London High has done today actually is produce an evidence-rich report. And that's why it's worth taking seriously.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks to Nick and Sunday, Mike Ratcliffe, everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.